I wanted to talk not just about Pan-Africanism and history of Africa. I also wanted to talk about the role of education and women in the future of Africa. And I had a chance to interview Dr. Ndoye Asie Lumumba. She is a professor of African and African diaspora education, comparative and international education, social institution, African social history, and the study of gender in the Africana Studies and Research Center at Cornell University. Dr. Asie Lumumba earned her PhD in comparative education, economics and sociology of education from the University of Chicago. She has two masters and two BAs in sociology and history from Université Lyon in France. She is currently the president of the World Council of Comparative Education Societies, vice president of the Scientific Advisory Committee of UNESCO's Intergovernmental Program for the Management of Social Transformation, and she is the past president of Comparative and International Education Societies. Dr. Asie Lumumba, welcome.
Thank you.
Your work has many different facets in academia and otherwise, and you have worked a lot on women and gender issues. In Africa, compared to other parts of the world, women and gender issues, why and how are they different?
Well, they are part of the world where we have similarities, even globally, we have similarities. But Africa has its own specific historical trajectory. And as a historian, my training in history, sociology, and economics of education. So I look at contemporary issues in historical perspective. So I see that African women have actually lost a lot in terms of their prominence in all the affairs of the community. The type of state we have today, they were created by colonial decision. By that time, African women were playing major roles in society. They had a complementary conception. Well, I know many Western feminists have seen complementarity as a biological concept, but that's actually what exists in society, because not anyone can do everything. And the important thing is to value what everyone does. Okay, so I have no reservation to use the concept of complementarity. When the African societies had dual governance system in the political arena, for instance, and it was less individualistic in the sense that a man cannot stand up and gather his army and take power. It was the process through which men and women participated. And the governance itself was also for men and women. They had their respective spaces, but it was conceived that with the space occupied by men alone, you cannot have a society. With the space organized, held by women, you cannot have a society. So you have to come together. It also brought the concept of checks and balances. And so you could see when the Europeans, after the Berlin Conference, started to occupy the African land, you can go through the entire continent and you tell me where men and women did not rise up. It was not the men's responsibility alone. Women contributed. There were parts where women took the lead and they suffered the same consequences. The bloody policies of the colonial system, where they executed leaders, where they deported leaders, it applied to women. I give a few examples. In what is called Zimbabwe today, Nehanda was executed, hanged. She was hanged because she refused to accept the domination of the British. Yaa Asantewaa in what is called Ghana today. She was sent in exile when she organized, mobilized, without the British bringing other armies in the other colonies, Ghana would have been a second Ethiopia, they would have defeated the British, but they brought in more support from elsewhere. So what decision when they captured Ya Asantewaa? Defiant. They took her and she was exiled in the Seychelles Island. You have the African map, you have the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
When they take you from West Africa, put you in the Seychelles Island, how can you mobilize? Yeah. The point I'm making by using these two examples is that men and women had equal responsibility in all the arenas, politics. That's why when they felt that their freedom, their well-being, their countries, their culture, their civilization were under attack, women didn't wait for men to give them order, to tell them what to do. They knew what to do to contribute to save their societies. So this changed when the Europeans took over and organized the African societies according to the colonial rule. You can see literally women being pushed aside. Literally, year after year, two phenomena through which women were pushed aside. One was that those Africans who were organizing resistance, the leaders, they had to be eliminated. And I gave you an example of women who were also eliminated physically or rendered capable of guiding, ruling when they were sent into exile. The second decision they all took was to train a new leadership, in quotation mark, because a true leader must look at the interests of his or her people. So the Europeans actually were training puppets, whom they called leaders, who would be in agreement with the colonial rule. And what did they do? They sent to school against their will. Not that the Africans were enthusiastic. We talked recently about even L'Aventure Ambiguë, Hamidou Kan. Yes. So it is a novel, but that represented very much the reality. So the Africans were not enthusiastic to send their children to school. First of all, the colonial school was a place of terror. Secondly, they realized that by educating the young people, you're taking away our future, because they will not think like us. They will not think about their own societies. They will not defend our societies. Mind you, the men and women who took arms against the Europeans is based on the education they received, the African education, which, contrary to what they were saying, had ideas. It was not only technical to farm. The education of the African included ideas about values, ideas about freedom, about ideas about what is the moral, the ethos, the collective ethos, okay? So it was with that education, the African education, that they felt really empowered to defend their society. Yeah. But then in order to prevent them from that from continuing to happen, they had to educate, in quotation mark, their future leaders. And how did they do it? They selected the males only. About sending their daughters to school either. Because they realized women represent a lot in society. They were at the center. They are the one who train, educate the young people. And a lot of studies today in psychology and other fields show that early childhood development is critical in what happened in the future. So the Africans were fully aware of the fact that women were the ones who were responsible for that early childhood education. And therefore, if they wanted to send their children to school, particularly the girls, it would mean they would have to give up they would lose Africa. They would lose what they represent. Yeah. So it's a very important use very skillfully by the Europeans, be they French, British, they all, even if their policies differs, they had the same goal of controlling the African. And you control a society, you control a people by controlling their mind. And you control their mind by sending them to the proper, you know, education, quotation mark. Carter Woodson, an African-American, a great philosopher, historian, he talked about the miseducation. So they were educating the African, but miseducating them from outside. So that was critical. So even if the Africans didn't want that formal education, little by little, it became an instrument, a tool, a powerful tool to be able to write, to be able to speak the language of the colonizer. So it put the men, a handful of men, at an advantage, even if this is not how they plan it. So that contributed to make the women de facto ineligible in the participation process. When you have to speak the language of the colonizer to participate in the political process, but you don't speak it, it means you de facto eliminate it. So there are many, many mechanisms through which the African woman, as I mentioned, if you follow them historically, you can see literally them being pushed at the outskirts of society to the detriment of Africa.
Yeah. That's true. I mean, we can even see it, even outside of Africa, where a good example would be Harriet Tubman, a woman that was not educated, who couldn't read, couldn't write, but had a very clear concept or understanding of freedom. Yeah. In your experience, what have been done or experimented in Africa that would bring women at the same level to build a better Africa?
Allow me 1 minute to refer to what you have mentioned when you refer specifically to Harriet Tubman. Women of Africa, when they were uprooted from the African continent and were brought on the side of the Atlantic as enslaved people, from the African continent all the way to the moment of Black Lives Matter, women, girls have been very much part of the struggle. Every struggle for freedom, women, you take them to the first enslaved society or woman to a person to negotiate freedom was a woman who came directly from Africa to Jamaica, Nanny of Jamaica. She fought the British with her African education. Actually, in some of my studies, she came. She was forced out of Africa at a time when her contemporaries were also very powerful on the African continent. It's the same thing here in the African-American communities, in Brazil, you name it. The struggle for freedom was considered, and it is still considered, the responsibility of everyone, not men alone. So it's the European type of patriarchy that sees the man as the center of the universe, literally, that has disrupted, no matter how much women contribute, it would be considered of less value. Regarding the question of what African countries have been doing, well, by the time of the decolonization process in the 1950s, it had become very clear that the European education was a powerful tool. So when you acquire it, in the Europeanizing societies, then you have possibilities of negotiating your place in broader society in terms of occupation and definitely in terms of the policy-making arenas. So African countries made a formal decision to promote education for all, There's not one single country that after its independence did not embrace the idea of equal educational opportunity. And actually, it was framed as free and compulsory in terms of the basic education. So it is there. Every single text, every single constitution, every single education reform document stipulates that. But then one thing is to have it in the book. One thing is to make those powerful pronouncements. It's another matter to provide the actual resources that are needed. And that's where African countries have not done well. If you look at the education statistic, you will see some differences. In Southern Africa, for instance, you have high enrollment among the female population. In the case of Lesotho, for instance, you see the reverse of what you see in other African countries. It means the majority of the students from elementary school to the university are female. And it's not because the policymakers there are more enlightened. It's the political economy of apartheid that created those situations. And then even when they are formally educated, when they have far more formal education than the men, they still do not occupy the position that they deserve. So these are some of the disruption, the different meaning of education, the European type of education that you see across the continent. So indeed, in terms of policy, there have been all these adoption, legal adoption in the national assemblies, parliament, that we should have equal educational opportunity, that there should not be any discrimination. All the international policies that have been promoted, we have adopted them. But the reality on the ground is very different. So what is lacking is the resources. Resources and also the inability to transform our African systems to make them fit the contemporary or vice versa. What do I mean? In the African societies, women were in charge of the domestic work, in addition to also being farmers, in addition to being traders. They were actively involved outside, but their outside involvement had a connection directly to the inside responsibilities. Like we compare an old system to a current system. In an old system, women and girls would be doing those works. Men and boys would be also performing other works. But when you move fast forwarding in the contemporary context, you send a girl and a boy to school. I'm not talking about highly westernized, affluent societies, but the majority of the people who are still using their own labor to produce and to prepare the meal, to take care of the household, girls are more involved in the household chores when they come back from school. I have done research in different countries. One that I remember vividly was in São Tomé and Príncipe, where I did a very formal data collection, but I did many informal discussions. And one that I remember vividly, a group of students, secondary school students, they were coming back from school. And then I asked them, what will you do when you arrive home? The boys typically said, I will go to play soccer. And when yes, and after that, I will go to harvest some coconut. Why? I will use the coconut to, I will sell it so that I can have some money to ride a taxi to school instead of walking all the time. Yeah. And the girl, what will you do? And then after dinner, they will do their homework, okay? So it's all together. The girl, what will you do when you arrive home? I will help my mother. You see the difference. After sitting down in the classroom all day, after walking from school, the boys are going to have some relaxation by playing soccer. The girl has to take care of, taking care of the young brothers and sisters, cooking with the mother or the female adult, and then washing the dishes when the food is, the meal is consumed. And what will you do? Well, wash the dishes. And then if I have time, I will bake some coconut cake. Coconut is very important. I'm using this example because it was so real in terms of the children in their environment. Why do you want to bake the coconut cake? Well, so that I can make money and I don't have to walk always to school. I want to ride the taxi. You see, boys and girls have the different plan. But when you look at the timetable of the girl, when will she have the time to do her homework? When she's exhausted. Yeah. So this is an example that shows that is the system of education today has different requirements than the type of education in the African context. Therefore, we have to adjust to it. So instead, this is where the gender reallocation of responsibilities. Instead of having girls only cook, women themselves have to learn to call also their sons to help. And it will be very important for them in the future if they learn how to cook, how to take care of a number of things instead of being dependent. So it may sound like unusual and a heavy chore, but it's learning for life. Yeah. So these are some of the major issues.
Yeah, definitely. I can speak from experience. I mean, that men do need to cook because I came in here and I had to learn at a very advanced age. Yes, definitely. You have made or talked and made an assessment on the Millennium Development Goals.
Yes.
Right, talking about these policies. Has it had any effect, any guidance on how our educative system need to be reformed? What is basically your assessment on it?
Well, the Millennium Development Goals ended in 2015, and now we are in Sustainable Development Goal. But before the end of that Millennium Development Goal, I was invited by African students who are in Canada in a province of Alberta, and out of that we published a book. We were very critical of how much could be achieved by the Millennium Development Goal. So the point I was making earlier is that African societies must, even if they're looking for partnership, they have to design their own system. They have to find their own priorities. They have to follow them. They have to look for the necessary resources to fund the policies that they know are important. Africa is where it is as a reflection of where African women are.
Yeah.
Vulnerability of the African continent, African countries, is a reflection of the vulnerability of African women as a result of their exclusion or their marginalization or a de facto unequal distribution of resources. So the Millennium Development Goal, you see, I made a criticism in the book that I'm mentioning. One criticism I made was that in the entire Millennium Development Goal, there was no reference literally to higher education. So the Millennium Development Goal didn't mention higher education. Of course, we know when you look at the educational statistics, the majority of those who are unable to read and write are women, young women, girls, who will never set the foot in a classroom. So this is a reality. But this is where we have the catch-22. If women are not present, where the decisions are made, those issues will not be automatically raised and addressed. It should not be the responsibility of women alone. Men, and there are many enlightened men, but it has to be systematized. I have in front of me here one book that I wrote, edited with many contributions, Women and Higher Education in Africa, Reconceptualizing Gender-Based Human Capabilities and Upgrading Human Right to Knowledge. So for me, we need to go beyond functional literacy. We have to be serious and very, very committed to making sure that men and women are educated to the same level, that they contribute to the production of knowledge. They contribute to the decision-making process, informed decision-making process. And when they participate in the political process, they have the full intellectual capacity to understand, to assert themselves, to work on behalf of their communities. So the Millennium Development Goal, to come back to your question, the mere fact that it focused on basic education, literacy, but nothing about higher education, I felt that it was a major failing by not mentioning that. Because if we are not represented at all the level, and Africa as a continent, as a region of the world, we have very low participation in the production knowledge. We consume knowledge produced by others. We still accept policies that others design for us, but they don't design it in a blind way. They design it according to their own knowledge, their own vision, their own understanding of Africa, you see. So these are some of the issues that I have with the Millennium Development Goal. And also, it was not the first time that Africans participate as members of the United Nations African countries in a global commitment. No matter how really unanimously the decisions were made, ultimately it will be at the level of each country, because what they do is to recommend. So it's a moral plea that it's important to give equal education to the males and females. It's equally important to push the boys to succeed and to push the girls to succeed, to allocate the same resources, that because they are all equal. So that's a moral plea. The actual and policy-based decision rests entirely with the individual countries. So regardless of how greatly the Millennium Development Goals were articulated, it's a few countries made a lot of effort. I know countries like Uganda, Kenya, they were trying really hard to meet the goals. But what will be more important to set the goals that Africans themselves see as necessary and important,
right,
and do their very best to achieve those goals?
Yeah. It's hard for me to even not tie that into a wider framework, this whole development of Africa as getting out of poverty, but also most important as being united, the whole African Union.
Yeah.
You take all these countries, small, some big, where we cannot basically get out of poverty, right? You take a small country like Gambia or Senegal, you cannot go it alone.
Yeah.
Without sounding nationalist. And you're right about that. We need African solutions to those problems because we know exactly what works for us. And we have people on the field who understand the problem and understand what solutions need to be implemented.
Yeah.
So to just segue into the unity of Africa, isn't it part of the problem us forgetting most of our history? You mentioned powerful women, and not because we have one or two or three. It's just that was the norm. Women were part of everything.
Yeah. Losing our history and not valuing it, because you can be taught your history in the negative term, okay? I mentioned an African-American historian, educator, a few minutes ago, Carter Woodson. Yeah, they teach you to glorify Europe, the great achievement of Europe, and they teach you to think that Africa did nothing So you may feel so embarrassed that you don't even want to know. Yet, Africa is not what other people have defined it. Africa is where it all started. Cheikh Diop, the great Senegalese physicist, historian, archaeologist, linguist, he broke all the barriers among disciplines. But more importantly, he was a physicist. Well, he wrote in many disciplines. And one of his works was that at the time of the transatlantic enslavement, Europe as a whole was not far ahead of Africa because different European countries were at different levels of what could be called development, although we may question even the meaning of development. Development, it is not just building stones, stone building and all that. It's the sophistication of the human spirit, the ideas. So Africa was not far behind Europe, but the transatlantic enslavement derailed Africa. It derailed Africa, brought to this part of the world many able minds from the continent and created chaos in our societies. So that contributed to delay Africa. And then once the transatlantic slavery ended, came the colonization. So we had no peace to think, to organize, to regroup, to catch up from where we were disrupted. So there's a need to reconnect with that history. A great African historian and philosopher, Joseph Kizerbo, the late Joseph Kizerbo from Burkina Faso, in his book, Histoire d'Afrique, d'hier à demain, History of Africa, from yesterday to tomorrow, he argued that by embracing learning from our history, it doesn't mean that we need to use Ali Mazrui's term, some kind of Gloriana, creating, imagining a glorious past. Human societies are not always only glorious. They have their contradictions, they have their issues. So it's a matter of presenting African history as it was, as it has been, African contribution to thinking, to philosophy, to building structures. If we do not embrace that history in its totality, with all its deficiencies, with all its glorious achievement, then we will be unable to really position ourselves toward the future. I would like to use the Akan representation of, you may know of the Sankofa bird. The Sankofa bird is that mythical bird that is flying. And when you see it, it's looking back. It's not flying back. It means you cannot go back to the past, okay? But you can learn from it. And then in the beak of that bird is an egg, which many people often miss. They just see the bird looking back. Right. There's an egg. That egg is a very powerful statement about our future. The future is delicate. Handle it with care. You see? Yeah. So you need to connect the past, learn from it, empower yourself from it, learn to fight whatever in the past was not great that you don't want to reproduce, but feel empowered by what made it possible even for you as a people to be where you are. Because there have been many aggressions on the African people. If they had not been strong, they would not exist as a people. So what did hold us? What did make it possible for us to come to this era? So history is critically important. Those who think that let us forget about that history and look forward, it means they don't realize that if you don't know where you're coming from, you cannot have any idea where you're going. Okay? And then you cannot take advantage of the opportunities of the present moment. You cannot be aware and prepare against all the challenges. So history is important, and so we have to make sure that we reintroduce. UNESCO here did something great. It started the General History of Africa, which was taken to its fullest realization under the leadership of the Honorable Mbatha, another great Senegalese who headed UNESCO for many years.
Yeah.
And it has continued. So this project should be at the continental level. Our children need to know where they're coming from. They need to know of all the deficiencies. They understand that human beings cannot be only great. There were wars, but why do the Europeans choose only to focus on tribal wars? That was the same thing in Europe. If you go and check the national anthem of Belgium, and you'll find out the first sentence, the first verse. Okay. So it's not only Africa that has problems of the past, or the European societies, but we need, even if it had been only terrible, we need to embrace it, affirm, appropriate it, and decide that this is where we want to go.
As learning one.
From it. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, as one. I think the other tragedy, even like you said, that we never had rest, right? Colonization. Before that, slavery.
Yeah. So
even after independences, and I want to put it in quote, really,
yes,
in the 60s.
Yes.
We talked about the last time about the assimilation of French colonies.
Yeah.
Today, we really want to work hard toward a united Africa. So Pan-Africanism is a thing. I don't think it's going to die. It's even bigger than Africa. We're talking about all people of African descent, right? People in Africa and abroad.
Yeah, yeah.
But that idea, that balkanization of African countries,
yes.
Right now, when you talk about Mamie or other heroes, say in Ghana or Nigeria, I cannot learn of it. I cannot really associate with them just because of my world is contained and very narrow. It's all about what the French colonizer had taught me.
Yeah.
And the tragedy is we keep continuing that thing.
Yeah.
How do we get out of it?
Well, one thing I said earlier, the critical importance of education, that even if one day they leave the continent physically, they would still be there because they would control the mind. And when they control it, like the puppeteers, they can sit wherever and then make them act. That's a very cynical, but as a historian, you read the archives and you realize that there was a recipe to produce the kind of leadership we have. But then education is that, maybe I mentioned it before, education is used by those who are in power to reproduce, to control. But it has a property, some characteristics that nobody can control. It means once people know how to read and write, it doesn't matter the condition in which they learn how to read and write. It doesn't even matter sometimes the language in which they learn how to read and write. They will use that knowledge to read the world, to paraphrase Paulo Freire. You learn the words, you read the words to read the world. Okay.
It's very powerful.
So that the colonizers understood it very well. How do we remain perpetual? Particularly in Africa, education was critical, was fundamental. And so it's not only the worst are the French. The French colonial system is the worst in this obsession of controlling the mind. But eventually they all came to the same policy, different methods. So when African, most of them acquired their nominal independence, at the creation of the Organization of African Unity, 1963, this is where Africa was lost. When we have great leaders like Kwame Nkrumah, Kwame Nkrumah lived for 10 years in the United States. He went back, not only with his formal education, but with his reading of the world. He realized that even big states like Texas, Florida, California, New York, they would not be as powerful The United States of America is uniquely positioned given this unity.
Yeah.
They have their contradictions, they have their differences, but they form one country, one nation. And people like Nkrumah understood that. Who will talk about Ghana as a world power? But when you have Ghana, Nigeria, South Africa, when we all come together, we will count in the world.
Yeah.
So that was the idea of the Pan-African perspective in the Organization of African Unity. But then the colonial power, the neo-colonial forces worked so hard, particularly the French. And I'm not afraid to say, it's a fact, historical fact that I'm repeating here. They worked so hard to make sure that we would not unite.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have read Kwame Nkrumah, Africa Must Unite. Why Africa Must Unite? You read it, you will find out. But that unity was not to the pleasure of many, particularly the colonial powers, those who represent their interests. That's why, as you mentioned, it still continues. Because if they had not been able to reproduce, to find people who are willing and happy to reproduce it, it would have died. That colonial ambition would have died. And they need to understand. So it's not either or. By Africa advancing, it doesn't mean that you do not advance. Let's all advance. But I have faith in people like you, in our children, even those who were born here. Their commitment to Africa is such that sooner or later, it will become impossible for those who want to prevent that from happening, for it to happen. Even if it is only symbolic, the fact that the African Union has now a sixth region, you know, the five regions, they have added a sixth region, the diaspora. Well, the diaspora is encompassing, is the old diaspora, and is the recent and ongoing diaspora. So we will all feel that one day, this, just like formal colonization, just like formal slavery, they have to end.
I'm torn. I mean, I'm excited by your optimism in Africa or the future of Africa. At times, I really fear that we won't get there. A good example is where actually Professor Molefi Kete-Asante talked about it. He talked about Afrophobia, and this is within the African continent, where, say, in South Africa, you would have immigrants coming, say, from Nigeria or Zimbabwe, and not welcome. So we're losing that part of one Africa. And you're talking about now, today. That's quite dramatic, I think.
Education must play its role. People must understand. Otherwise, they will reproduce what was handed to them as a framework. You have to be afraid of the African people. You have to be afraid of Black people. That's the tragedy in the case of South Africa. But you don't react when people from other regions of the world come. There's no reaction. Yeah. But when the African, the Black people, you see? So it's the same thing here in the United States. You learn in the slave mentality what Malcolm X called the hatred, self-hatred. You hate yourself and you see the Black people in front of you, it represents that rejection of yourself. So there are many, many psychological, educational dimensions that we must address. So why am I optimistic? It's because precisely you cannot control the mind perpetually.
No.
You can't. It's impossible. Otherwise, slavery, you know that the enslaved Africans here didn't have the right to education. It was legally forbidden to seek education. It was legally forbidden to provide education to enslaved people. But even after formal education became legal for them, the system has not made it easy for them.
That's right.
Yet, it keeps producing those minds that challenge the system. So this is where my optimism comes from. No matter how strict the system of control is, there is always that little possibility that the creative mind, that the bright mind, the mind seeking freedom as ultimate right for every human being, they will seek all avenues. And it's important not to seek those avenues alone, is to be creative in organizing networks. And it has been amazing how in the assassination of George Floyd, how Black Lives Matter has galvanized the world. So it doesn't have to be something so grand, but in whatever environment you live in, you have to refuse to accept the status quo of the values promoted during slavery or during colonization.
Yeah.
And sooner or later, they will have to understand that it is also in their interest that they don't keep preventing us from trying to acquire our free human right. That's where education must also play its role from our side. We need to educate them as well. To understand is that it's indeed a universal human right for people to have education, to be living lives that give meaning to why they came to this world. Okay?
Yeah.
And in order to do that, we have to work together. And the common humanity is not like a commodity. It's not like the minerals, where the more you take away, the less will be left for others. The humanity is infinite. Everybody can have. It's just like happiness. Because you're happy, it doesn't take away my reason for being happy. But we have to create the condition for everybody to feel that they have their humanity. It took a long time for the United States to amend its constitution, to restore the human dignity to the formerly enslaved Africans by taking out from there, well, they didn't take it out, it's there in the original constitution, but it was amended that they were no longer three-fifths of human, they were full human being. So people will keep fighting for it. So instead of using our energies fighting, why can't we work together and imagine a world where we can all have something, where we all can enjoy our common humanity. So this is where, perhaps because I'm an educator, it's not only I see also many people, the challenges are real, they will be there, but we have to keep fighting until there is an acceptance that we all matter, that we have one common humanity. In fact, on planet Earth, you see, we share that planet. Yeah.
And that's Ubuntu.
Yes. In that, it's not only us human trying to assert our humanity, common humanity, it's also recognizing the other inhabitants of the earth, the trees, the animals, the whole ecosystem. Next time you go back to Senegal, ask in the tradition how they work the land. If they had some kind of right here I'm talking about R-I-T-E-S, where you respect the land, the belief that the land has a spirit. Well, is that wisdom that we need to treat the land right. And if we treat the land right, it will treat us right. It will allow us to plant our seeds and harvest our crops, feed ourselves. But we have to create that balance.
That's So it's more of a very holistic
approach
to basically bettering ourselves and our lives.
Yeah.
I just wanted to just brush back a little bit on the education. And as an educator, and as far as curriculum goes, is there anything that's being done? Have people from African Union perspective, have people been engaging educated and educators like you as far as defining some sort of curriculum? Just because the reason why I'm asking, today, when you talk about education, at least in the West, it's all about STEM. In our case, history is a must. Like, is there anything in your experience that's been defined as far as how can you educate our people as one?
Some countries that shall remain nameless even took out history up to a certain level. It's a tragedy. But I know in at least one of those countries, people are fighting back to reintroduce history. Because it's all decided early on, you know. The idea you have of yourself, the idea you have of the people you connected to, and history will also teach us, as I was mentioning earlier, to embrace the less glorious aspect. Questions that are asked and still are being asked here is the descendant of the those who came from the transatlantic enslavement. Why did your ancestors sell us, our ancestors? Well, of course, no one here present participated in that. But it means that those who were forced out and those who remained there. Of course, not every society participated in it. But the point here is to have this broad conception of Africa. And therefore, whatever happened in the past, we embrace it. We learn our immediate history, but we learn also the history of global Africa. How do you explain, for instance, the great walls of Zimbabwe? Okay. How do you explain if you the first time I saw the Tutankhamun exhibit, it was brought to the US many, many years ago. I was a graduate student, and it was Chicago was one of the three cities where they took that exhibition. And I went to see it. One thing I remember vividly, some of the jewelries. I felt, you know, what are some of the things you may not see that I'm wearing here? Some of are the jewelry back to the 18th century that were brought to where Côte d'Ivoire is today through a migration led by a queen. So these are the realizations that we need to know. What happened when there was that big migration from the what is now the Saharan Desert? You know, they have found many, many things under the sand, rocks with painting that show that it was a greenery. If you visit Cairo, go to the campus of the American University in Cairo. They have a section of trees that have become like a stone. They call them petrified trees, showing that in that area, which is a desert today, used to be a place of greenery, gigantic trees by the trunk that you can see. So if you learn all these things, then it is really important. So the point I'm making is you need to learn global Africa. When I say global Africa, I'm using a term dear to Professor Ali Mazrui. It means you learn also about the Africans who left the continent. But we don't want to also link our history of migration to only trauma. I mentioned to you a book to read, Ivan Van Setima, They Came Before Columbus. Those Africans from the Senegambian region who used to come freely, their free will, who used to come to the Caribbean, the American, the Gulf of Mexico. There are huge statues today that can be traced directly to those Africans who came. And the definition of Africa today as a dark continent, Africa need to open. Well, it has not been the Africa of history. If it had been the case, actually, if it all started in the African continent, then the rest of the world would not be populated because the Africans would have remained feeling that security, not having that curiosity of the mind. What is beyond the ocean? What is beyond the horizon? That has been very much part of the African history. So when we talk about global Africa, is to embrace those before Columbus on this side of the Atlantic, those who traveled across the Indian Ocean, have settled in many parts. When you see them, you know, many people in the Pacific Islands, when you see them, you recognize people in your community. It's just amazing. So global Africa is that, embracing all that history, because static people of the dark continent, as it had been depicted, do not go and explore the world. And you explore the world with scientific knowledge. Even in chain, those who came with culture, came with knowledge.
Dr. Asiye Lumumba, thank you very much. That was Dr. Asiye Lumumba. The conversation doesn't end here. Join us online on Facebook or Twitter, or go to our website, enmeri.africa. And don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify.